This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco. It's 7 o'clock.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, we're talking about juvenile sex trafficking in the Bay Area. When people hear the term sex trafficking, many assume it is an international problem that takes place in areas like Asia or Eastern Europe. Yet the FBI has identified the Bay Area as one of the 13 hotspots across the country for sex trafficking, especially for girls under 18. In fact, three of the most concentrated locations where sex trafficking happens are also here in California. In response to this growing problem, in 2012, over 80% of California voters supported Prop 35, the so-called CASE Act, which stands for Californians Against Sexual Exploitation. This proposition strengthened prosecution for sex trafficking and mandated training about commercial sexual exploitation of children for all California law enforcement officers. Tonight on our program, we will explore juvenile sex trafficking in the Bay Area. Why are so many girls caught up in what is sometimes called the life? And what is the impact of Prop 35 on juvenile sex trafficking? What are local leaders, prosecutors, social services agencies, and police departments doing to help end this problem? And what role does mobile technology and the internet play? Joining us to discuss these questions and more are four Bay Area experts in the area of juvenile sex trafficking. Here in the KLW studios, we have Nancy O'Malley. She is the district attorney for Alameda County and a nationally recognized expert on issues involving violence against women and interpersonal violence. In 2010, Ms. O'Malley launched the HEAT Project. It stands for Human Exploitation and Trafficking Watch Program, which is a replicable, multidisciplinary approach to combat human trafficking that is being used as a model across the country. Welcome, Ms. O'Malley.
Thank you.
We're also joined here in the studio by Inspector Antonio Flores. He has been a member of the San Francisco Police Department since 1982 and as part of the Special Victims Unit since 2001. He has prosecuted hundreds of crimes related to domestic violence, sex trafficking, and elder abuse. Welcome, Inspector Flores.
Thank you very much.
And by phone, we're joined by two guests. Nola Brantley, she's been advocating for child sex trafficking victims and survivors since 2005. Nola co-founded MISSY, an organization in the East Bay dedicated to serving youth trafficking, sex trafficking victims. Under Nola's leadership, MISSY, which stands for Motivating, Inspiring, and Supporting and Serving Sexually Exploited Youth, served over 1,000 children and youth and trained over 15,000 professionals in the field. Currently, Nola is working as an expert in this area and a master training through her company, Nola Brantley Speaks. And my understanding is that we're still trying to get Nola on the line, so we'll bring her in as soon as we can. And also by phone, we have Chris Kelly. He's a Silicon Valley attorney with a long track record of representing innovative companies and making the internet a safer place for both kids and adults. As the first chief privacy officer and general counsel for Facebook, Chris helped the company develop key safety and security policies, and he was one of the leaders of Prop 35, the Californians Against Sexual Exploitation Act that we mentioned earlier, a successful grassroots effort to combat sexual trafficking in California. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to the rest of my guests for being here this evening. And also welcome you, our listeners, to the conversation. You can email us now at cdvisions@klw.org. You can also post a comment at the KLW website, or you can give us a call in about 20 minutes at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. So, Chris Kelly, I wanted to start with you. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in the Prop 35 movement.
Well, I had gotten involved originally in focusing on online exploitation through my work at Facebook and before that at Excited Home and a number of other internet companies in the Bay Area. It was stunning to me how much was going on and how, you know, entitled a lot of people who were using the internet for exploitation felt. We had a closed network Facebook focused on college students, and we expanded that over time. And as we expanded it, at every turn, people who thought that they were entitled to come on and attempt to sexually exploit children would show up. And so it was amazing to me to see how brazen it was and how aggressive it was. And so we wanted to do more and more to combat that. Part of that was technology that we built over time, but we realized that some of it had to be laws. And I had gotten involved in what became Prop 35, primarily through pushing to expand the sex offender registry to include the trafficking offenses where they haven't been hadn't been previously included, but also to include internet identifiers so that it was easier for online companies to identify those who had previously tried to sexually exploit youth.
And so tell us what were the key, or what are the key provisions of Prop 35 that sort of changed the landscape in terms of what could be done in terms of prosecution of these perpetrators?
Well, we wanted to pursue a comprehensive strategy. And, you know, Nancy and NOLA and their work and all the work of law enforcement across the state needed some enhancement and a comprehensive strategy to rethink the way that the sexual exploitation, human trafficking is going on. We wanted to increase criminal penalties to match federal penalties so that people understood that this is going on in our communities, and we need to empower the 58 DAs in California to go after this in an aggressive fashion. We needed to think about and train law enforcement better about how they thought about what were traditionally seen as prostitution cases to actually focusing on the trafficking behavior that underlies most of them. We needed to, you know, be more aggressive on the internet and think about this next generation of exploitation, have provisions on that. And we just needed to raise awareness aggressively and get this on the ballot. You know, it had been a long slog that Nancy and Charmaine Bach in her office and Daphne, my partner in California Against Slavery and my co-proponent of Prop 35, had worked very hard to enhance the laws over the years. I had been focusing on the internet side, and Daphne and Charmaine and Nancy had been focusing on a lot of the you know, traditional, you know, criminal prosecution side and social services surrounding this. And we went to the legislature repeatedly and tried to get things to move, and things weren't moving. So that's why we put it on the ballot, and luckily 81% of Californians, more than 10 million Californians, voted for Prop 35.
Yeah, that's a pretty high number. My understanding, it's the highest percentage since propositions began in 1914 here in California, no matter what you think about the proposition part of our voting. But I wanted to ask you, 81% makes it sound like, you know, a lot of people kind of are aware of this issue. And my sense from the background reading I've been doing is that, you know, this is a relatively hidden problem. What was your how much did it take in terms of energy to get the electorate to kind of get this and to focus on it? Obviously, you succeeded, but I'm curious what your path was like.
The number one problem that we had is that people wanted to believe that this couldn't be going on in their communities. And no matter the you know, facts that they saw before them, they often want to think that this is a problem that's consigned to the third world or someplace else. You know, when a lot of people talk about human trafficking and what goes on, they think that's something that happens in Southeast Asia or in Eastern Europe or someplace that's somehow backwards. But it happens in Fresno and Sacramento and Los Angeles and San Diego and San Francisco. You know, that the line prosecutors and line law enforcement, they see it every day. We wanted to make sure that these are charged as crimes that they are, and I think that the, you know, the record of both of the electorate willing to say this is a common sense measure and we're all going to vote for it, and then the, you know, empowering, you know, the law enforcement officials to step up and charge these cases as trafficking cases, it's bearing itself out quite nicely.
So tell me a little bit about what you've seen happen as this proposition has been implemented, or the law behind it has been implemented.
Well, I think Nancy's going to be able to go through, you know, quite a number of these cases and some of the things that she's seeing day to day. But, you know, we're seeing cases that would often be just rolled up as prosecution, as prostitution cases, rather. We've seen cases in the Central Valley in the last weeks. We've seen cases in Orange County. We've seen cases in San Diego. It's happening across the state where, you know, a few of these high-profile charged cases as trafficking cases, we think will start to deter one of the things that we had seen, which was, you know, criminal gangs that have traditionally engaged in drug trafficking moving into human trafficking because you can sell people over and over again. Hmm.
Did we lose? It sounds like...
I'm still here.
You're still here. We lost somebody else, but...
Okay,
Chris, you were saying that gangs had moved from drug trafficking to human trafficking.
Because it's a repeatable business. You don't have to get, you can only sell the drugs once. You can sell people over and over again, and the economics of it worked out better. And I should add the other thing that we wanted to do quite emphatically, and it contrasted markedly with what the legislature had planned to do, to say that they were combating human trafficking. They wanted to raise fines to $25,000 for trafficking offenses. We enable criminal fines of up to $1 million. We wanted to make it clear that anybody who thinks that they can sell people for profit in this state is going to have every dollar that they've ever collected taken from them.
Hmm. And so it sounds like you're pleased with where things are going so far. What do you think are the next frontiers to tackle this problem?
Well, this was a smart and comprehensive strategy. California Against Slavery, which I've continued on the board of with Daphne, we've worked on demand side bills, and we think that there should be harsher penalties for demand in these cases, and we'll be working on those, hopefully getting through, signature and enactment, as we stay engaged in the process. The empowerment of prosecutors was the main purpose of this, and I'm sure that our law enforcement panelists will be able to go into the depths of what we've been able to do in that space.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a little bit of the history of most recent ballot measures that have helped to strengthen the prosecution and support of survivors of juvenile sex trafficking.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really, really glad you've got a great panel to discuss this.
That's great. Thank you.
Have a great night.
That was Chris Kelly, a Silicon Valley attorney and first chief privacy officer and general counsel for Facebook, who helped to develop the Californians Against Sexual Exploitation Act, which we just heard a little bit about there. So I wanted to introduce or welcome Nola Brantley. Are you there? Hello, Nola? I think we're still having problems with Nola being patched in. So I want to go ahead then and turn to Nancy O'Malley, District Attorney for Alameda County. I wanted to unpack a little bit about what Chris was saying. He kept referring to the difference between prostitution and trafficking. And I think it's really important for our guests if we kind of get some baseline facts right here about what we're talking about when we're talking about juvenile sex trafficking.
Well, when we talk about prostitution, really we focus on adults who choose to engage in commercial sex. They're sex workers. And when we're talking about juvenile sex trafficking, we're talking about children, some as young as 11 years old, certainly under 18 years old. Many of the young people that we see are under the power and control of an exploiter, someone who has either befriended them or has taken control of their lives and then put them on the street or put them on the internet. We call that the track, putting them on the street. And a lot of these young women think that they're going to have a boyfriend. I put that in quotes. A lot of them think that this is the first person who's ever cared about them. I put that in quotes. Or someone that actually loves them. And we see a lot of demographics on why girls and boys might fall prey to someone who take advantage of their vulnerability or their bad circumstances in life. So for those children, the sex trafficking is putting them into the commercial sex environment and then requiring them and in some respects forcing them and torturing them to engage in commercial sex acts for money. And remarkably, none of these young people that are engaged in this behavior ever see the money. It all goes to the exploiter. When girls or boys try to get out, we've seen far too many cases where they've been either beaten, tortured, sexually assaulted by multiple people, or murdered.
Hmm. That's quite a grim picture there that you paint. Tell us a little bit about the demographics.
So what we see in Alameda County, also identified as a hotspot part of the Bay Area, is, and we've done a lot of data research so that we can try to understand not only what is happening with these kids that they find themselves in this situation under the hands of an exploiter, but also what can we do to help them once they're rescued and recovered. About 82% of the kids that we've seen are have a history of running away. We see about 1 in 4 kids have been in foster care, and or it's even higher percentage, but kids report back to us that about 1 in 4 in foster care have actually been trafficked out of foster care. We see kids who are self-medicating and or have a substance abuse issue, about 50% of the kids. Many of them have mental health issues, understandably. They've lived under trauma. Almost 100% of them that we've seen have been sexually assaulted as youngsters.
Would you say that the mental illness precedes the trafficking, or is a result of, or both?
I think it's more likely the result of. We see children who started being exploited when they were infants, or 1, 2, 3 years old, and all the way up until the time when they fall in the hands of the exploiter, who then starts marketing them, using them as a human ATM machine. And I think the mental health issue is what people do. Their own psyche has to shut down, so they don't have to look at or appreciate all of the bad things that have happened to them at the hands of the people who are supposed to take care of them.
Mm. And then in terms of, you mentioned both girls and boys, so what's the split there? And then along other types of lines, socioeconomic, racial, ethnic, the geography even. Tell us a little bit more there.
So from our numbers, we created a program called Safety Net in Alameda County. And so far, since 2011 through this month, we have looked at or worked with 417 kids. 1% are boys. Now, we know that trafficking is going on with boys. We know sex trafficking is happening. It's not exactly the same dynamic, and it's not as visible as what we're now what we're seeing with girls. So we're primarily looking at data that involves girls. In Alameda County, about 65% are from Alameda County, but that means 35% are not. And we see kids that are being brought here from all over the country. We see a lot of kids, as Chris Kelly said, kids are coming here from Central California, from Southern California, San Diego, L.A., Sacramento, the Central Valley, and end up being trafficked in Oakland, which is itself it's a hotspot.
Right, I believe is an international boulevard.
It is.
That is quite the hotspot. Or is that the track that you were referring to? Yeah, we did a show on this a few years back, and I remember some compelling discussion around that specifically. So I wanted to now welcome Nola Brantley. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Sorry for all the technical challenges to getting you on the air tonight. To remind our guests, Nola Brantley co-founded MISSY, which stands for Motivating, Inspiring, and Supporting and Serving Sexually Exploited Youth. And she's also a master trainer and works through her company, Nola Brantley Speaks. So I'm not sure how much of the program you've been able to listen in on, but I wanted you to add your take from your work in this area about, sort of, again, trying to make sure we're painting the most accurate picture for our listeners about who is it that is exploited and what kinds of things we need to know about as we delve into this discussion.
Absolutely. I think that, I believe that was Nancy that was just speaking.
Yes.
And she was painting a really good picture of, you know, who the victims are that are impacted by this. What I would add to that is that these are really individuals who have had their choices taken away from them due to two main things. One is poverty, and the second one is violence. So a lot of the individuals that are victimized by the commercial sex industry and by human traffickers, the reason why they're so vulnerable is because of poverty and a limited amount of options due to poverty and violence. I think another thing that we're seeing, especially in the East Bay in Oakland, which is a hot spot for this, is we're seeing a lot of generational poverty and generational sexual abuse. So many of these victims come from families that have been living in poverty for many, many generations, and where the women in those families have also suffered rape, sexual exploitation, sexual assault, and sexual abuse, really sometimes dating all the way back to the slaves.
Hmm. So you're saying...
So we're talking about modern-day slavery now, but we also have slavery in this country, you know, a long time ago, and there are ancestors of those slaves that are still in this country, you understand?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of sexual assault and sexual abuse and rape that was used during that time, which was some of the first trafficking that happened in this country, and we see a lot of that lineage of generational poverty and generational sexual abuse and assault that these victims are coming from.
So it sounds like from the way you're describing it, given how entrenched it's been and how sort of enmeshed it is with other social problems that are intractable, it feels like something that that's really hard to penetrate and to break apart. What are your thoughts about the key things that society should be doing, whether it's social services, law enforcement, education system, to really start to pick away at what seems to be a very self-reinforcing situation here?
I see two things, really. There's two things that stand out to me right away. I think one is we have to look at poverty in the Bay Area, right? We have to look at poverty all over the world, but we have to look at how poverty is impacting certain communities in the Bay Area and their ability to have options and alternatives that would not lead them to be preyed on and be vulnerable to human traffickers. So I think that's one thing. I think another huge thing that we can't deny, because especially in the state of California, but even throughout the country, children, especially foster care children, are really the feeder into this business of child sex trafficking. So I think we really need to look at the children that are in the foster care system, the children that are coming out of the foster care system, and why are so many children in the foster care system being targeted and victimized by sex trafficking? That is something that we can't deny and that we can't ignore.
Hmm. So poverty in general and the foster care system. Anything else?
Well, I think that, you know, the issue of violence, but I think the issue of violence is very much tied into the issue of poverty, because I think the levels of violence that people are experiencing sometimes is taking away their ability to make choice, the same way poverty takes away their ability to make choice. So they find themselves in situations that they don't want to be in, like in the clutches of a sex trafficker because of violence, and they didn't feel like they had an option because of the violence.
And that's Nola Brantley speaking. She's been a longtime advocate for girls that have been exploited through the juvenile sex trafficking here in the Bay Area, and has worked to be a trainer and an advocate in many ways. And I want to turn next to Inspector Tony Flores of the San Francisco Police Department. A couple of things here. One is we've focused a lot on the East Bay, so I want to hear a little bit about how San Francisco fares in this area. And then talking from the perspective of someone who's working day-to-day with survivors and exploiters, kind of what your perspective on this problem is, and what are some key issues we need to be bringing out in terms of looking for meaningful and lasting solutions.
Oh, well, thank you. First off, we, the police department, it was the brainchild of Chief Sir. He took together different disciplines in the San Francisco Police Department, and he noticed that sex crimes and juvenile and domestic violence, elder abuse, missing persons were all kind of scattered. And what he did was he formed the Special Victims Unit and actually brought us all together under one big umbrella. So who we have in our team, and basically we talk, and part of the way to at least to understand the problem and continuing to communicate is amongst each other, especially when we're doing cases. So we have missing persons, domestic violence, stalking, juvenile crimes, internet crimes against children, mental health, elder abuse, sexual assault, and then there's human trafficking. What I bring to the table is I was in the domestic violence unit for instance that I started in 2001 until now. And what I noticed immediately when I got into the area of human trafficking, and Nancy would probably agree with this, is that I noticed they were very similar with the domestic violence and the human trafficking as far as the power and control. Why I could understand why this individual wouldn't leave a situation. I could actually relate to them why they would stay in this total abusive, bizarre situation and not get out. And I'm that person that can speak for them, or at least to educate others. And programs like this really do help the community to understand, because hopefully your listeners out there, they will be part of the juror pools that are out there. And as I say to the victims and also say to the perpetrators, is you're going to explain your story. You're going to have your opportunity to explain what you were doing to 12 to 13 people here. And when it comes out of your mouth, you're actually going to tell them what it is, why you didn't leave. And then I'm going to clean it up for you. I'm going to explain the reasons why you stayed in the situation. Mm-hmm. And when you're looking in outside and you go, well, they could have left at any time. And you're like, no, they really couldn't. They didn't have options at that time. Or maybe the controller, the modern-day slave owner over here, had their child or actually knew where they lived or was going to target somebody else of them. Or maybe, let's call it what it is, the money was too good to walk out. Mm-hmm. They got used to that lifestyle, and it is true. The thing that I can offer to them is possibly their soul or their dignity back, and that's what I can't go against the money. The money's just really too great. But it's really important that we have this partnership, not only with the district attorney's office, but also the nonprofit groups, the community groups like, you know, Missy. It's I can't do this job without them. So for the enforcement portion of it, you know, we have different things that we do. And we'll have these decoy operations where they're very different from the old style of decoy operations where we used to put a decoy female officer on the corner and kind of stand there and wait for, you know, the what I would call the tricks that would come up and approach them. And then they would get propositioned or they would offer, you know, sex for money, and then the arrest went on. Well, we knew things have changed. The internet has literally blown up in our face and has changed things. And one of the big players at the table is obviously my Red Book. Especially in San Francisco, you can Google My Red Book and you can kind of look and you can do search of a city and you can put San Francisco and, you know, within a second, you're going to see the postings and you're going to see the live postings and you're going to see, you know, the times. And there you have these people that will come out and say, hey, I'm here for just, you know, a little bit of time. Or then there's key phrases in there, fresh, young, barely 18. You're going to see some of those things which are indicators to us that possibly that individual might be an underage person. So then what we do is we set up our own little Red Book ad, and you'd be amazed how many people we get. And we get all kinds. We've gotten doctors. We've gotten famous chefs. We've gotten people from Twitter. We've gotten people from all over the country. So it's amazing, not to say Twitter's bad. Again, this is something that we are seeing, and I think probably Nancy's seeing the same thing. It's just different things. And I thank her for mentioning the boys, because I always, you know, we always talk about this, but we forget about the boys. And the boys are different from the girls. And a lot of them are independent. But again, what she says is they can either come from broken homes, or they're runaways, and they're basically in survival mode. And I'm going to have to do what I have to do this thing. So we not only cater to that one particular operation, but we'll cater to another one. The other things that we do is, well, it's very important that law enforcement truly understands what it is. And again, Nancy will basically say this, is that back the way we used to deal with prostitution was we'd go right after them, just say, we caught you, we saw you talking to them, and that was the end of the dialogue. There was no more dialogue. You've been a thorn in my, you know, behind, you're going to jail, and that was it. But not really taking the opportunity, unless you have a juvenile, and even then it was like your worst nightmare. You don't want to really deal with them, and you really never dealt with the problem. Now, as I tell them, take 5 minutes. Just take 5 minutes with this person and find out what it is. You know, ask them those questions. Hey, have you eaten? And that little word, have you eaten yet? And sometimes they say, no, I haven't eaten. I haven't eaten for days. Oh, come on, let me buy you something right here. And just show compassion. You know, sometimes take the uniform off and just give it 5 minutes and have that conversation. And again, they've been programmed a certain way and they've been told a certain way. And they said, well, if the cops come up to you, you don't tell them nothing. You start getting in their face or, you know, just keep lie. You know, they're not going to help you. It's me. It's about our family. And you're part of my family.
You're talking about the exploiters here.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's very hard. It's very hard. What am I going to sell you? I have to sell you something different than what this person sells. And that's why I say, I offer your soul.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're discussing juvenile sex trafficking here in the Bay Area and the impact of Prop 35, which was passed back in 2012. With our guests, Nancy O'Malley, District Attorney for Alameda County. We just heard there from Inspector Tony Flores of the San Francisco Police Department Special Victims Unit. On the phone, we have Nola Brantley, advocate for trafficked girls and founder of Nola Brantley Speaks. And earlier, we heard from Chris Kelly, former Chief Privacy Officer of Facebook and champion of Prop 35. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. Are you aware of trafficked girls in your neighborhood? Do you know anyone who has been a victim of sex trafficking? What questions do you have on this topic? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment at the KLW website. So, Nola Brantley, I wanted to come back to you. Inspector Flores painted his version of how he sees this and how he inspires some of the people who work with him to interact with the victims or survivors of this. Tell us a little bit about what you know are some of the things that will help to dislodge victims from this life. It sounds, as we talked about earlier, it's quite an intricate web. What are some things that you know can be helpful here?
Well, there's some. I mean, it starts from some really basic things. So, really, the basic right of safety. So, if the clients, you know, if the victims, and you know, when they come to an organization like Missy or an organization like Sage in San Francisco, our clients, if they don't feel safe, it's going to be pretty difficult for us to do any of the other work with them. And if they don't feel safe and they feel like the only one that can keep them alive is the person who's actually abusing them and trafficking them, that's the person they're going to stay close to because it's a matter of survival. So the first thing is trying to establish safety for the young ladies. After we're able to establish safety for the young ladies, really the next thing is their basic needs. Do they have their basic needs met? Do they have a place to live? Are in that place they live, are clothing and food and, you know, hygiene products being provided? Yes, these very basic things. Because although the victims may earn a lot of money, especially the children, they may earn a lot of money by being sex trafficked, they don't keep money. So it goes through their hands into the traffickers' hands in many cases. And so many of their very, very basic needs have been unmet in that trafficking situation where they don't have clothing and they don't have simple things like hygiene products, you know, for themselves. So we look at those very basic things. And then beyond that, we're doing the more long-term work of really trying to express unconditional love, the sense of like a surrogate family, because for many of these children, they don't have family. And just because we rescue them, a family will not pop up. So we try to provide the idea of surrogate family and then the idea of transformative relationships. So really being able to form a connection with the girls and through that relationship, that being a tool to help them move towards a brighter future. And, you know, for many of the girls, these are some of the same things that the traffickers themselves used to coerce them and manipulate them because they were so desperate for love and for family and for relationship that those were the very things that were used to coerce them into the commercial sex industry. And our goal oftentimes in doing victim services is to show them the true meaning of those things and to use those tools as a way to bring them towards a brighter future, not as a, you know, a way to coerce them or hurt them, which is a big way they've experienced it in the past. So that's a big part of, you know, what we do. Many of the children that are victimized are also part of the foster care or juvenile probation system. So it also takes a lot of working with their social workers, with their probation officers, with their therapists. You know, it takes a team of people, not just like an advocate from a nonprofit agency by themselves, but really a team of people coming together to make sure that they can maintain that safety for the victim who's now becoming a survivor and also maintain the idea of family and relationships and love. Because if one person tries to give all of that, it might be too much. But to come together as a team and a community and kind of wrap around that child and provide those things seems to be a successful model.
And so how do the girls get to you in the first place? And what does it mean for them to take that step? My sense is that they are really risking a lot.
Absolutely. So the way the girls get to organizations like Missy or even organizations like SAGE or Love Never Fails or different organizations doing this work is usually by either the organizations do street outreach themselves and go out into the street and pass out information that victims may follow up on, but more often the agencies get referrals from law enforcement, from social services, from probation, from hospitals, from parents, and also directly from girls that find out about the program walking in from off the street. So that's really, you know, how the victims get to the services. But in terms of them taking that first step, it's usually based on them making connection with somebody at the program. That's why I say these ideas of unconditional love, transformative relationships, and surrogate family are really what help us, you know, to work with the girls. And it's really building that first little morsel of trust. So when a girl is able to build that first little morsel of trust with you, you know, as a service provider, then there's a chance she might just take that first little teeny baby step. You know, she's not necessarily going to just jump all in or jump all out, but she might take a little baby step, and then you have to keep building the trust with these victims until you're able to get it to a place where you're really able to help them and make a difference, because their trust has been fractured in so many ways. Like, one of the impacts of the level of violence and trauma they suffer is they have a loss of belief not only in faith, but also in humanity. So it means that the level of violence that these children often suffer leads them to believe that nobody in this world will help them or do good for them. So it takes time to get them back to a place where they actually believe that you, as somebody, you know, actually wants to help them. Because in their experience, every person that really pretended like they wanted to help them abused them, sold them, beat them, and took advantage of them in some way.
And on average, how long have the girls that come to you, how long they've been exploited for before they seek your services?
Oh, well, like Nancy said, you know, it could be that they started getting exploited by a parent who was addicted to crack when they were like four, who was letting the drug dealer have sexual contact with them in exchange for getting drugs. And then, you know, later on were victimized by a trafficker or a pimp, you know, a pimp at maybe the age of 12 or 13. So many of these girls, by the time they reached us, they've been experiencing sexual exploitation and sex trafficking for a number of years. The average age of entry into the commercial sex industry is between 12 and 13 years old. But on average, we don't identify them until they're about 15 or 16.
Wow. Wow. I wanted to turn next back to Nancy here. Nancy, we've talked a lot about the girls and the boys to a certain extent. Tell us about the perpetrators. And now there's various levels here, right? There's the end client, so to speak, and then there's the exploiters themselves. And tell us about kind of what you understand to be the organization of these types of gangs in some way, in some cases, and other criminal outfits. Tell us a little bit more about what you know about that.
So the perpetrators do vary, as you said. So I'm going to focus first on the exploiters. And there's some interesting studies that were done in Canada some years back that identified, and I'll put in quotes, pimps. Although I personally don't use that term because I think it lets people off the hook for what they're really doing. They're slave owners, they're exploiters, they're rapists, but we'll call them... The studies that were done in Canada was really about pimping. And what they found was that it's the highest percentage of sociopaths, people who don't care about the fact that it's a human being that they're exploiting, of any other category of criminal. And that's really frightening, because if the exploiter is a sociopath or a psychopath that is only using this child or this other human being as a human ATM machine, then they don't really care if they're hurt. They don't care if they're exposed to disease. And if the girl or the boy tries to get away, they don't care if they just kill them for breaking the rules or breaking the code. We're seeing kids who are being branded. Literally branded. We see kids who, again, they're being gang raped to keep them in compliance when they start to try to get away, as Nola was talking about. We also see we started seeing some younger men who are getting involved in it, maybe because they were drug dealers who then turned to, as Chris Kelly said, they were drug dealers who then turned to selling children instead, because you can sell a child over and over and over again, but you can only sell a drug product once. The other thing is that if the drug dealers used to be the most visible people because they were on the street corners. Now they're in the back in the shadows, and they've got this the child who's the one who's visible. And then we are seeing, especially in the brothel industry, the ones that are running houses, that we're seeing more women who own those houses who are the exploiters of other women who are a lot of times are here from other countries, who come over here thinking they have a job to do one thing, and then their passports are taken away or their papers are taken away, and they're forced into the commercial sex world.
How about massage parlors?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, some of them, the police know. We just, in my county, just took down 18 different houses that were operating around the county. We had over 300 police officers who all executed search warrants at the same time, which was 11 o'clock in the morning. At that time, there were already customers that were in these places that supposedly were just opening. And there's a huge amount of money, a huge amount of cash that runs through those types of industries. And we have filed charges against, I think it's 18 defendants, and rescued 50 women who were forced into the commercial sex world. When we talk about the demand, this is a challenge. Chris Kelly talked about Prop 35 and the big difference that it's made in our ability to identify the exploiter, the one who's trafficking the child or adults. And by the way, Prop 35 didn't just deal with sex trafficking. It also dealt with labor trafficking. But what we haven't done is we haven't built up strong enough punishments and being able to prosecute those who are purchasing. We see purchasers come from all over the Bay Area, driving into Oakland, driving into Berkeley, driving into Livermore, driving into other parts of our county who don't live in the county. And they're really trolling the streets looking for children. They're on the internet, as Tony said, looking for children, looking for young women or men or boys. And that demand right now, the way California law is, there's no separation between somebody who's just engaging a person who's a commercial sex worker versus someone who's out looking for a child to have sex with or to rape. And we really need to change our laws, and we're working on that, trying to strengthen the laws against the demand side and to really give such a huge disincentive that it will make people think twice about that. Engaging that kind of behavior.
It sounds like the mobile technology and the internet has really changed the game here, as you've described. How is it hampering efforts? And I'm looking at both you, Inspector Flores, and District Attorney O'Malley. How has it hampered your efforts to kind of really take down organized groups or get at the perpetrators that you describe?
Well, for us in law enforcement, it's actually been a great aid because we get to follow some of the trail. Like if we encounter maybe some of the workers in the industry, that we're able to take their phone and we immediately snatch their phone. As you can see, I'm grabbing it, my mm-hmm. phone, and I'll start looking at what information is in there. And then all of a sudden I can see that there might be like certain key phrases, and then with that I can link it right into their ad, which is whatever they've posted. And sometimes they'll even have the pictures that they took, the selfies that they've taken of themselves to make the ad, and it's still here on the phone, which then is actually in the possession of the controller, the slave owner. Mm-hmm. And so that person, again, you can see all the link. I have her phone or his phone, and then I have the controller's phone over here, and immediately I've made the link. So it's really a nice tool for us, especially when everybody's, let's face it, when they go to court and when we're at that in front of the 12 to 13 people, that everyone's very nice, everyone's very proper. But then all of a sudden, when Nancy blows this big posting, this big ad that they put up that talks about exactly what it is, showing the pictures of the child here that they posted onto this thing, it has a big impact. And everyone tends to turn to look at that person and goes, oh, no, this is a little more than just it was an accident or we were just taking fun pictures. And again, the internet really has helped us out in law enforcement. It's made our job a little bit easier. And then now we've used social networks like Facebook. We'll go out there, and I'll say it, we'll go out there, we'll play a role. And in these roles to see, as she says, these predators that are out there that are constantly looking for this this fuel, this fire, to see if they can get somebody, a young child, to come out and to be with them and then start that communication with them.
415-841-4134 if you want to join our conversation tonight on City Visions here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco or on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing juvenile sex trafficking in the Bay Area with Inspector Tony Flores of the San Francisco Police Department Special Victims Unit, Nancy O'Malley, District Attorney of Alameda County, and Nola Brantley, advocate for trafficked girls and founder of Nola Brantley Speaks. 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org. Let's go to Jim from Berkeley. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hello. I have a couple of insights in this. There was a big mistake made to the war on drugs that has really created a lot of these criminal organizations. And I'm worried that we're heading down the same track, that And I laud the effort to try and separate minors from the sex industry, but I think that step one would be to do something along the lines of what Nevada's done, making adult prostitution lawful. And that way, the brothel owners will have an incentive to keep children out, to keep their licenses, the same way that alcohol purveyors currently don't sell to minors because they're concerned about losing their liquor license. Because we're not going to stamp out the sex industry entirely. It's been around for thousands of years, and it's obviously not going to disappear. There's also exploitation where there are no advertisements. For instance, landlords having sex with their tenants in exchange for rent, where it's a very coercive situation. People aren't committing survival sex. And a third issue is labor contractors in the Central Valley that hire illegal immigrants and then they are sexually abused in the fields. And I think that contract laborers need to be focused on in the Central Valley. I'd like to hear some comments about that.
Thanks so much, Jim, for your comments in there. So, Nancy O'Malley, Jim was expanding the scope a little bit of our conversation tonight, but if you wanted to just comment on what he had to say.
So I don't support legalizing prostitution of adults.
Neither do I. Sorry to jump in there, Nancy, but I just want to say neither do I.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. And I think that there's a lot that goes on behind that process. And we rescue a lot of women from adult sex work and help them get into a different track of their business, of their life. On the labor trafficking, I agree that we do have an issue and we have to be more aggressive at going after employers or those who would engage workers and then either use sexually assault them, which we do see in the farm worker industry. But we also see employers who are engaging in labor trafficking, where they're bringing up workers or bringing in workers from other parts of the country, or day labor. It's the underground economy where the employer will have someone work for the week and then not pay them and say, who are you going to complain to? You have no documentation. You're not here legally. There's nothing you can do about it. And in my office, we've been very aggressive at prosecuting also labor trafficking. And because people will put up with a lot, as the gentleman caller said, that, you know, people will put up with a lot in order to survive. And that we see that in the labor world. And I'll just say that from the juvenile sex trafficking, in the last 8 years, we've prosecuted almost 400 felony cases against traffickers. And that's almost half of what the state of California has done. And we're working very hard to make sure that my colleagues around the state and law enforcement, as Tony does and my office does, training law enforcement to recognize trafficking and then respond to it appropriately. We work closely with Nola Brantley and all of the people that she has trained to be advocates. And that's one way that we're making a big difference and making a big impact in our ability to keep kids safe and adults safe who are being trafficked.
415-841-4134. If you want to join our conversation, you can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org. Let's go to Millie. Millie, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you very much. This is a fascinating program, and I wanted to ask you, I know some teenagers, young teenagers, and I wonder how you suggest we inform them of the danger they're in.
Okay, thanks, Millie. Inspector Flores?
Education. That's where advocates, that's where the police department, that's where the district attorney, everybody gets together and we do some kind of education. And we've done that. And I know
Nancy
has done that.
What kinds of programs do you have?
So what we do is we work with a lot of the nonprofit groups. If you the history of SVU is that even before it started, that we had La Casa de los Madres, two advocates that were assigned actually purposely at our office. So we understand that not everybody wants to talk to law enforcement. We understand this. And so what can we do? And with that, I think we do a lot of outreach with that community. And it's all about a trust. It's really, truly about a trust and understanding everything, especially to the young people. And I think one of the things that I've gotten is probably Nancy's have seen this too, is a victim impact statement. And I've probably what it is the victim gets to get up in front of the court and the defendant and basically tell them, that person how they feel and how this crime or whatever's going to happen to them has infected their. And I can tell you, of all the things I've been to is a victim impact statement. And I was at one where that person got to look at the perpetrator. And with the family and said, this is what you've done to me. And at the end, after everything, we're in the hallway, she goes, Inspector, I want you to have my original because it's you that believed in me. It was you. And I took that paper. And that same day, I had a juvenile that was about to go into the court. I said, she was terrified and scared and everything. I go, you know what? I just got this. Why don't you read this? Mm. And she read it. And afterwards, after she was done, She got on the stand and she said what she had to say. And I knew as soon as the words came out about the abuse that she found, I said, she's got it. She's got it. And she said back.
That's a question I've been wondering about is how hard is it to get the survivors to come forward and face their perpetrators?
Well, it's obviously a very difficult personal decision that a victim has to make. It's the decisions that sexual assault survivors make. And, you know, I think that NOLA said it very well, which is our primary purpose, our primary focus is the safety first of the child and then making sure that they have a safe place, they have their needs are being met, and that we are then helping them rebuild a life or build a life in that respect. So a lot of it is making sure we have advocates present with the kids that come to court, making sure that we are, as a prosecutor, that we are vigilant about fighting for the rights and protections of children in court, and then assuring that our interest is not just to get a conviction, not just to prosecute a bad guy. Our interest is making sure that that child knows that she is loved, that she is cared for, that she matters in this world. In my office, we take an extra 10 seconds to look people in the eye. I mean, that's the first rule. Look at kids in the eye so they know that they exist and that they're valued and that they're loved.
Is there witness protection here? Is the risk that great for girls coming forward?
For some, there is. And we have witness protection availability if there's a threat to their safety. We actually have a bill. I'll be up there testifying. We're sponsoring a bill to allow us to do conditional examinations if the child's life is in jeopardy or there are some perceived threats being made by the perpetrator or at the hands of the direction of the perpetrator, that we can do conditional exams and then relocate kids or return them back to their family. Because, you know, we have had children of police officers who have ended up in Oakland and things like that. I do want to say one quick thing about we respond absolutely to the crime of human trafficking, but we're really embarking on very strong efforts to prevent trafficking in the first place. Let's talk to our kids when they're youngsters. Let's give that effective intervention when we first or somebody first learns that a child or suspects a child is being assaulted in their home or is not being cared for. I'm working with the school districts in all the districts in my county. We've actually created a series, a graphic novel. I used to call them comic books, but it's a graphic novel series called Audrey, and it kind of chronicles what happens to kids. And we're working not only with children in school to talk to them about these safety issues, but also their parents or their guardians. How do adults talk to kids about these safety issues without scaring them to death, but at the same time helping them become aware?
I think another thing that's really, really critical. I mean, we have, you know, we have a certain population of kids that meet a certain profile that puts them at a much greater risk. But then you have all children who are at risk, and I think a big link to that is the internet. Children have to understand the dangers of the internet. They have to understand that who they meet on the internet is not always who they say they are. Parents have to be more committed to monitoring their children's online activity, including their Facebook accounts. All of the phone calls that children get can't come through their cell phones, so that parents never have any ability to know who their kids are communicating with. For many kids who do not meet the typical profile of foster care or previous abuse who are victimized, oftentimes the internet is involved.
And do you want to say anything else about, Enola, about the raising awareness piece?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to say that we have an organization in the East Bay called Love Never Fails, and they've developed a prevention curriculum that they are launching in the Oakland Public Schools. I'm also involved in a couple of efforts in Southern California to develop some prevention curriculum, and there's one that we've all been using for a while that came out of Boston called My Choice, My Life, My Choice. So I wanted to say to that caller who asked about, you know, if they have teens, that there are some prevention curriculums out there that can be used with teens that are, you know, targeted towards kids who have not yet been victimized, but can be used with teens. There's also a new website that was just developed by one of my colleagues, Janice Jacobs, called Abolitionist Mom. And the website is targeted towards parents and teachers, and it has a ton of different resources, books, videos, etc., that can be used to help raise awareness with young people as well as parents and teachers.
Okay. And in the last couple of minutes here, Nancy, I wanted to ask you, what are some barriers at this time in terms of being able to get your job done in terms of legal barriers? What happens, given that we know that trafficking is crossing county borders, how are you working with counties across the bay, like San Francisco or other counties, to really get at this problem in a regional way?
Well, I think the regional response is critical. We created a program called BAC, which is Bay Area Heat Coalition. Heat is human exploitation and trafficking. And that means that we're all talking to each other, not just in the Bay Area, but around the state. We also, some of the other barriers are that we have to really be able to educate juries that this is not where some child's being dragged off the street in the dark of night. There's a lot of coercion. There's a lot of destructive seduction. I mean, I'm using that term not in a healthy way, but in a very destructive, horrid way. There's a lot of duress that goes on that isn't always so obvious. And juries need to understand that that's how so many of these kids are lured into this life or lured into the power and control of the exploiter. And, you know,
and can I just add in there with you, Nancy, too, that part of that challenge, too, is that a lot of times these victims don't present as the best witness because they have suffered such a high level of trauma. Oftentimes they're suffering from Stockholm syndrome and trauma bonding. So that challenge that Nancy is talking about is really, really critical, too, because of how the kids present sometimes as well.
So we're going to actually, unfortunately, have to stop it here. There's many more areas we could go into in terms of discussing education and prevention and tools for prosecution and reentry of girls into or exiting from this scourge that you describe. I want to thank our guests this evening. Those were District Attorney Nancy O'Malley from Alameda County, Enola Brantley, Inspector Antonio Flores from the San Francisco Police Department, and Chris Kelly. Thanks to all of you for being on the program with me tonight.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Vision's page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Victoria Thorpe, and Susie Britton is our senior producer. Join my co-host David Onick next week for a conversation about citizen journalism and the so-called hyper-local news coverage that's developing in San Francisco. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.